the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO provides free training in all aspects of operating a radio station. We're looking for folks who benefit from white privilege to attend the Beloved Community 101 training on Saturday, December 16th from noon to 3 p.m. This workshop focuses on understanding how KABU culture and our programming culture affect the station, how do we keep the program charter alive, how do we keep each other accountable on the air and off the air. If you're interested, please RSVP by email to del@kabu.org for a seat and for the location of the training. Again, that's the Beloved Community 101 training on Saturday, December 16th from noon to 3 p.m., hosted by your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your Friday evening news. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, open daily December 16th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade art, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at 2 Southwest Ankeny in Waterfront Park. More information at portlandsaturdaymarket.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, 180,000 Oregon residents could lose their health insurance if the Republican tax plan is passed as it stands.
A Multnomah County grand jury refused to indict a Portland police officer in the shooting of an unarmed suspect.
Oregon has joined with 17 other states in a lawsuit over the FCC's vote to roll back net neutrality rules.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, December 15th, 2017, the 333rd day of the Trumpocalypse. I'm Reuben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Yesterday, in a scene that has been repeated all too frequently around the country, a Multnomah County grand jury determined that Portland police officer was justified in shooting an unarmed suspect. On October 25th, Officer Ryan Regan fired six shots at 25-year-old Chase Peoples of Tacoma, Washington, hitting him three times. Peoples was the suspect in a separate robberies of a North Portland check cashing company and a bank. In both robberies, it was reported that a young black man had shown a note demanding money, but in neither instance did he display a weapon. Officers responding to the reports found Peoples in the vicinity and opened fire when he refused to follow their commands to put his hands in the air. No weapons were found at the scene. The Portland Police Bureau has said that they will conduct an internal review of the incident and the case will go before the Police Review Board. Peoples has been released from a hospital and booked into the Multnomah County Jail.
Yesterday, the Multnomah County Health Department reported that 80 homeless people died in the county during 2016. That was 8 fewer deaths than in 2015, but still more than twice as many as 2013, the lowest since the Domicile Unknown reports began in 2011. The reports found that deaths occurred in every area of the county and that over one-third occurred in public spaces. Opioids were a factor in half the deaths and alcohol in another 25%. Nearly 80% of the victims were male and 82% of the victims were white. In 2016, Multnomah County and the City of Portland created a joint Office of Homeless Services, with both governments contributing tens of millions of dollars in new funding for housing and services. The latest point-in-time homeless count shows that although the number of homeless people in the county increased by 10% from 2015 to 2017, a smaller percent were without shelter of any kind. Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kafuri believes that 2016 was a turning point. She noted a doubling of shelter beds, new shelters for women, couples, and families, and an increase in the number of seasonal and severe weather shelters. But Kafuri admitted that it's just a start, saying, quote, "It is clear that we have to do more. We do not have to be a place where people die on our streets," end quote.
An analysis of federal figures shows health insurance would cost more and cover fewer if the congressional tax bill becomes law. In Oregon, it's anticipated that 180,000 residents could lose their coverage. Eric Tegahoff of the Oregon News Service has the report.
In its current form, the big tax bill now nearing passage in Congress would raise health insurance premiums and force millions of people to lose access, according to one analysis of federal figures. Health economist Emily Gee with the Center for American Progress estimates that nearly 180,000 Oregonians would lose coverage over 10 years. She says that's because the bill repeals the individual mandate, which now requires people to have insurance or pay a tax penalty. Gee says without it, estimates are that annual premiums will rise.
If healthy people leave the insurance markets, that means that overall the average person is sicker. Insurers would need to raise premiums. The Congressional Budget Office thinks that would be about a 10% increase over the next decade.
Congressional Republicans argue that repealing the individual mandate would permit people who want to go without insurance. Gee counters that some of them would end up costing the system more by showing up uninsured in emergency rooms when they need medical care. Gee says that kind of uncompensated care decreased under the Affordable Care Act, but could climb again if the tax bill passes. She adds it's an especially serious problem for smaller hospitals.
Particularly in rural areas or areas where the hospitals are under a lot of financial strain, a big increase in demand for uncompensated care could be tough or even devastating.
The center also estimates that the bill would trigger $180 million in cuts to Oregon Medicare payments next year because of congressional spending rules. Gee says the bill would increase the deficit enough to force $400 billion in Medicare cuts nationwide over 10 years.
These cuts are automatic. You wouldn't see Medicare necessarily mentioned anywhere in the tax bill, but it would, by law, these automatic cuts would go into effect starting in 2018.
The bill supporters say Congress could decide to exempt Medicare from the cuts at a later date. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Portland City Council has agreed to pay $10 million to settle a long-running lawsuit. The suit, which was brought by a number of ratepayers, charged that the council was illegally using the water and sewer fund for pet projects and unrelated programs. City attorneys had argued the charter gives the council more flexibility in deciding how to spend utility ratepayer funds. Under the terms of the agreement, the city admits no wrongdoing but agrees to pay $5.5 million to the sewer fund and $1.5 million to the general fund. $3 million will go to the law firm that represented the ratepayers. The six-year-old lawsuit had charged that the city redirected water and sewer funds for unrelated projects, including $5.5 million on the Powell Buitt Reservoir Project, $2.5 million on Portland Parks and Recreation Projects, and $1.3 million spent on the public toilet project known as the Portland Loo.
Yesterday, the Federal Communications Commission voted 3-2 to scrap net neutrality guidelines that were implemented under the Obama administration. Those rules prohibited internet service providers from speeding up service for some websites or apps while slowing down or blocking others. The rules also prevented ISPs from charging more for access to one website than another. The vote came despite calls from state attorneys general, consumer advocates, tech executives, and even some Republican lawmakers to postpone or cancel the decision. Today, attorneys general from 17 states and the District of Columbia agreed to join New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman in a lawsuit to reverse that vote. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum was one of them, saying, quote, "We all rely on a free and open internet, and we will no longer have an even playing field if we start to incentivize big cable over other companies," end quote. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson also said he planned to join the lawsuit, stating that the FCC failed to follow the Administrative Procedures Act. Ferguson, who has sued the federal government before, said in a statement, quote, "We are 5-0 against the Trump administration because they often fail to follow the law when taking executive action."
According to an analysis by Wave, the traffic monitoring app, Portland has achieved the dubious distinction of having the fifth worst traffic in the nation. Only Honolulu, Jacksonville, Florida, San Diego, and Los Angeles are worse. The analysis takes into account factors such as delays, volume, safety, and road conditions, and confirmed what any Portlander already knows. Commuting here is dreadful. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in the 2 years from 2014 to 2016, an estimated 20,000 additional Portlanders began commuting to work by car, and more than 24,000 commuters spend over an hour each way. The traffic nightmare not only affects the quality of life for those unfortunates trapped in their cars, it has negative economic effects on delivery and courier services. According to a survey by the Portland Business Alliance, 80% of the respondents called traffic a major problem, and more than half said that it takes longer than it did 3 years ago to commute.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a cloudy day with occasional showers and temperatures in the low 40s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can also expect a more mostly cloudy day with a slight chance of rain and temperatures in the mid-40s. On this date in 1792, the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution, known as the Bill of Rights, were ratified. The amendments were added to the Constitution and include guarantees rights of personal freedom, as well as clear limitations on the power of the federal government. There are currently 27 amendments to the Constitution. The quote of the day is from Thomas Jefferson, who said, quote, "A Bill of Rights is what the people are entitled to against any government, and what no just government should refuse," end quote.
The political divide is as wide as it's ever been, and distrust of politicians on both sides of the aisle may be at an all-time high. But don't all politicians lie, and hasn't it always been that way? KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this commentary.
I take the threat very seriously. I take the fact that he develops weapons of mass destruction very seriously.
If you like your plan, and you like your doctor, you won't have to do a thing. You keep your plan.
We will honor the American people with the truth and nothing else.
It is widely understood that all politicians, including presidents, lie on occasion. The lies can result from incomplete or wrong information, or can be a deliberate misdirection on the part of the liar. But according to an analysis by the New York Times, we have entered uncharted territory in terms of presidential lying. A review of real-time fact-checking sources revealed that in the first 10 months of the Trump presidency, the Times documented 103 separate statements that were, quote, "demonstrably and substantially false," end quote. If that rate is maintained, it averages out to 124 lies per year. And many of the lies are told repeatedly. Using that same standard, the Times noted that President Obama told 18 lies over his entire 8-year term. They also observed that as soon as Obama realized or was advised that he was making false statements, he discontinued using them. Many of us think back to the Bush presidency and the lies that were told leading up to the invasion of Iraq. The Times points out that although real-time fact-checking didn't exist during the Bush years, their analysis suggests that Bush's behavior was more similar to Obama's than Trump's. For the most part, as soon as his statements became demonstrably false, he stopped making them. Trump, however, takes a completely different approach. When he is caught in a lie, he goes on the attack and tries to discredit the accuser. He has used this tactic with judges, scientists, law enforcement agencies, members of Congress, women accusers, journalists, and just about anyone else who doesn't sit idly by and accept his flagrant falsehoods. And apparently that tactic continues to work with his core supporters. Whether delivered by tweet, Fox News, or other right-wing delivery method, all Trump has to do is charge that something is false news, and the truth teller himself or herself is put on the defensive, and the truth itself becomes secondary. Now that it's apparent that Trump is a congenital liar, it's important that we develop a healthy skepticism of, quote, the news, end quote. We should be using fact-checking sites like Snopes or FactCheck as an example. We need to stop blindly accepting the facts from our favorite news source or social media platform and confirm consistency across multiple sources and platforms. If we're going to defend ourselves against the nonsensical ramblings of an egotistic madman and his henchmen and henchwomen, we must become educated consumers of the news and learn to distinguish the truth from what is truly false news. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton named Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith to fill the seat of Senator Al Franken. Smith is Dayton's former chief of staff. Last week, Franken announced his intent to resign after being accused of touching several women inappropriately. Franken's replacement will not change the balance of power in the Senate since both are Democrats. Smith will hold the seat until a special election in November of 2018. It is expected that at that time she will run to complete the remainder of the term. After the announcement, Smith said, quote, "Though I never anticipated this moment, I am resolved to do everything I can to move Minnesota forward, and I will be a fierce advocate in the United States Senate for economic opportunity and fairness," end quote. Franken referred to Smith as an excellent choice and said, quote, "She is a dedicated public servant who's worked tirelessly on behalf of Minnesotans. Governor Dayton couldn't have made a better choice for this job," end quote. Currently, there are 21 women serving in the Senate, 16 Democrats and 5 Republicans. This is a record for women in the upper chamber, which Smith will increase upon taking office.
Earlier today, two Republican Senate holdouts agreed to back the GOP's tax reform bill, and it now appears that enough Republicans may have lined up behind it to ensure passage. Yesterday, Marco Rubio of Florida expressed concerns, saying that it did not increase child tax credits for low-income families. But today he called it a, quote, "solid step toward broader reforms which are both pro-growth and pro-worker," end quote. Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee originally expressed concerns about the bill's impact on the deficit and was the only Republican to vote against the legislation in the Senate. Today, Corker set aside those concerns, saying, quote, "I believe that this once-in-a-generation opportunity to make U.S. businesses domestically more productive and internationally more competitive is one we should not miss," end quote. Final passage is still not guaranteed at this point, with Republicans Susan Collins of Maine, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and Mike Lee of Utah still publicly claiming to be undecided. In addition, Senator John McCain of Arizona is in failing health and currently receiving treatments for the side effects of chemotherapy at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. Democrats have uniformly lined up against the bill, citing its huge tax breaks for corporations and the ultra-wealthy at the expense of the middle and working classes. But with Republicans holding a 52-48 seat edge in the Senate, it appears that the Democrats have little hope of blocking its passage. Vice President Mike Pence postponed a planned trip to Israel in order to be available as a tie-breaking vote if needed. A vote is expected within the next few days with the intention of getting it to Trump for signature before Christmas.
According to an analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 16 states will run out of funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program by the end of January. Oregon is one of those states. And fully three-quarters of the states will exhaust their funding for the program known as CHIP by the end of March, unless Congress takes action. CHIP provides health insurance coverage for about 9 million children whose families have too much income to qualify for Medicaid, but not enough to afford the cost of insurance. Funding for the program expired in September, and although representatives on both sides of the aisle profess to support the program, a plan to fund the program has been set aside as the Republicans rush to pass tax reform. When the funding runs out, states face the prospect of terminating or reducing coverage, capping enrollment, or transitioning children to Medicaid. The annual cost for CHIP is about $16 billion, a drop in the bucket compared to the $1.5 trillion tax reduction the Republicans are pushing through. But with Congress unable to come up with a solution or even provide assurance that one is forthcoming, some states are already sending out mailers to families saying their coverage may be affected.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A tribal public broadcasting organization says revoking rules, which are intended to protect free and open internet, will only deepen the digital divide in Indian country. On Thursday, the Federal Communications Commission voted to repeal net neutrality rules. Many tribal communities still have basic infrastructure needs and lack access to technology, including broadband. And tribes rely on the internet for services and resources. Jeffrey Blackwell is the board chair of Native Public Media and former FCC Office Chair of Native Affairs.
The concern is that with the loss of net neutrality, tribal communities that are some of the most unserved communities in the United States with respect to broadband, it'll be slower for the internet to come, and that when it does come, that it will not be a true and open internet of all things, that our tribal families, our tribal children, when it comes to education and health care and job opportunities, that they won't have access to all of the resources they deserve on the internet.
Native Public Media is among groups which oppose the repeal, saying internet rights are civil rights. The decision could be challenged in court or Congress. The third teen involved in the brutal beating deaths of two homeless Native American men in New Mexico was sentenced Thursday. Gilbert Tafoya will serve 20 years in prison for the killings of Key Thompson and Allison Gorman. In 2014, Tafoya and two other teens beat the homeless men with cinder blocks, fence poles, and other objects as they slept in an empty lot in Albuquerque. The other teens, Alex Rios, was sentenced to 67 years for the murders, and Nathaniel Carrillo was sentenced to 26 years. Native American advocates have been working with the city and created a Native Homelessness Task Force. A new mayor was recently voted in, and advocates hope to start work with the new office to continue to address violence against homeless people. A park with sculptures dedicated to Native American leaders of the 20th century has been dedicated in Rapid City, South Dakota. As Jim Kent reports, the goal of the First Nation Sculpture Garden is to dispel stereotypical images of teepees and headdresses and move to a broader insight of the nation's first people.
Crow Creek Sioux author and educator Elizabeth Cook Lynn was among those who wanted to change the face of Native Americans for the general public.
We were thinking about changing the dialogue from warrior, massacre victim, and drunk in the street, poverty stricken, to what it is we have accomplished in the 20th century.
The 20th century was a time of amazing survival for Native Americans, says Cook Lynn, that she and those involved in the Sculpture Garden Project wanted to highlight. Those honored with bronze sculptures in the park include Charles Eastman, the first Dakota physician, Black Elk, defender of the Lakota language and culture, Yankton artist Oscar Howe, and legal author and scholar Von Deloria Jr. Cook Lynn notes that the Art History Project isn't complete. The next phase will concentrate on landscaping, with the final phase being the unveiling of a 20th century Native American woman. She hopes the First Nation Sculpture Garden can help to educate people about the reality of Native Americans, because education, says Cook Lynn, is the only solution to racism. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The Navajo Nation has lost another Navajo code talker. Teddy Draper Sr. passed away Thursday in Arizona, a little more than a week after code talker George Willie Sr. died. Draper fought in the Battle of Iwo Jima and received a Purple Heart as well as a Congressional Silver Medal. Funeral services are being arranged. Draper was 96 years old. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Earlier today, Donald Trump lashed out at the FBI, saying that, quote, "It's a shame what's happening with the FBI," end quote. He then told reporters on the White House lawn that, quote, "We're going to have to rebuild the FBI," end quote. The remarks followed comments earlier this month when Trump tweeted that the Bureau's reputation is, quote, "in tatters, worst in history," end quote. Trump's attacks on the FBI have been increasing ever since Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who is leading the Russian investigation, secured a guilty plea from Trump's first national security advisor, Michael Flynn. In today's comments, he also hinted that he might consider pardoning Flynn, but White House lawyer Ty Cobb later denied that a pardon was under consideration. After completing his verbal attack on the FBI, Trump then traveled to the FBI National Academy in Quantico, Virginia, to address the FBI's latest graduating class of U.S. and international law enforcement officers.
This episode of Climate Connections looks at the difficulties of running a ski school in Wisconsin, a state that could see temperatures 7 to 8 degrees higher in 2050 than they were in 1980.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When Steve Eliason was a teenager, he loved skiing in Wisconsin's snow-blanketed forests.
Moving physically, delighting in winter, in the snowscape, in the snow-covered cedars, when you're out there, it's just another world.
Now, he helps young people have that same experience. He runs an organization in the city of Oshkosh that offers free ski lessons to students. But as the climate warms, running a ski club is harder than it used to be. By the middle of the century, average winter temperatures in Oshkosh are likely to be 7 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit higher than they were in 1980. That means less snow for skiing.
It's not uncommon these days now, say in January or February, to have brown countryside.
Eliason has no intention of giving up. He believes skiing gives young people a rare opportunity to connect with nature and reflect on their place within it.
I don't know how you share that with students if not for physically, literally, getting out there in the world. And I worry there's far too little of that.
So even if there are fewer good ski days, he takes every chance he can to send a kid gliding through white powder for the first time. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. The producer for tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Ruben Lawrence. Coming up on Monday morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on More Talk Radio, Cecil and Celeste welcome Douglas Tsoi from the Portland Underground Grad School to talk about big data, racial discrimination, and privilege. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the great issues of our time. At 10 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks with journalist and explorer Edward Struzik about his book, Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. At 11, it's Intersections Radio. Sarika talks to Nidhi Chanani about her celebrated graphic novel, Pasmina. And at 11:30, Radio Zine presents Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and the world's reaction to Trump's Jerusalem Declaration. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Thank you for listening and good night. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Ruben. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, everybody.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Donald Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital further legitimizes and entrenches Israel's brutal and illegal occupation. But major U.S. media downplayed that context in favor of warnings about potential violence by Muslims in reaction to the move. For some perspective on the impact of the decision, apart from what it means for Trump on the world stage, we'll hear from Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project.